the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast is just two guys and maybe a guest or two discussing Bitcoin, Bitcoin equities, and the related macroeconomic space. It's not meant to be financial advice, so please, if you're doing any investing after listening to our program, do your own research, do your own due diligence, and understand that any money you invest can be lost. The show is meant for entertainment purposes only, and we hope you enjoy the program. Friends and enemies, welcome to another episode of the Canadian Bitcoiners podcast, Midweek Rip on the CBP Media Network. My name is Joey. I've been told, Len, on another call we were on this morning, that this camera makes me look swole. Do you think I look swole? You see me every week, a couple times. What do you think? Is that a weird question to lead off with? It might be.
Yes, I guess. I have no idea. I have to compare video footage from week to week. Do we have enough video footage you could compare, right? But the only unfortunate thing, you can't go back far enough because you changed your setting. And so it's going to be very difficult to make a comparison because of that. And now that you switched the camera, it's going to be even more difficult to do that. Joey, you got to be consistent. Be like Bitcoin. The code is what it is. It's not transferring to a proof of work. Sorry, proof of stake. Staying is proof of work.
I like it. We're expecting Pierre Rochard tonight. He's not in the green room yet. So sometimes this happens with guests. They forget or or they show up late. So we're going to do the ads. And we have a backup plan. If our friend doesn't come, we'll reschedule with Pierre if not. But Len, the sponsors, first and foremost, ShakePay, best place for Canadians to buy and never sell. Never sell your Bitcoin in Canada. Four things going on in addition to, of course, the always popular 30% back on your first $100 buy. $30 for $100 is not a bad deal. You get to keep, of course, all $130 in value. And on top of that, you can do whatever you want with the cash. Fill your, I don't know, where could you fill your gas tank? Maybe buy a hot dog, buy a corn dog, a 12-pack of Pogos, whatever. So they got that. They got four other things going on. They got shaking sats. Use our promo code CBP, Charlie Beta Peter, to sign up for the platform. You get sats stream to your wallet every day as long as you wake and shake, which I know many of you are doing. And if you're not doing it yet, you should be. You got the Shake Squads, you and four of your friends or four people you met on the internet or four people with Pepes as their avatars on Twitter or whatever. You guys are all buying stuff on your CAD card vis-a-vis the ShakePay app. Everyone gets 42 sats for every purchase you make. Can't beat that. Then, Len, they got the shaking. They got the Shake Paid. So if you spend off your CAD balance, you might just get the whole purchase comp in Satoshis, which you cannot beat. And finally, they also have now the ShakePay Save. What is it called? I do this every week. Shake Earn, something like that. I forget. ShakePay Earn. You leave some CAD in your account. They pay you out in Bitcoin in interest. You can't beat it. So all that good stuff going on at ShakePay. Len, who's the other sponsor?
Well, it's Ledin. And if you open up a account with our referral code below and you fund your account with 150,000 sats or 75 USDC and leave it on their platform for 15 consecutive days, Ledin is going to gift you 10 USDC, be added to your account, no questions asked. And also, so you probably have a large stack of Bitcoin because the price has been very good for people that are stacking away. And if you have some bills you want to end up paying because you obviously don't have much money these days because you bought Bitcoin with everything, well, Ledin is there to help you out. You could borrow against your Bitcoin with a 50% loan to value, and Ledin will give you the money. You're good to go to pay your bills. Also, if you think the price of Bitcoin is going up, like we're sitting at 20,300 right now, the price has to go up, right? Well, why not use Ledin's B2X feature where you could double up your Bitcoin stack? If you do this right, time the market correctly, pull out, well, you will now have more Bitcoin simply by using Ledin's B2X option and by, of course, timing that market correctly. And the last thing they have is the Bitcoin-backed mortgages. The home prices, they're coming down. You might as well take advantage of this. But keep in mind that the Bitcoin-backed mortgages, which is an industry first, is not available in every jurisdiction. So please check their website to see where they're offering that. But since you're on their website, check to see what the interest rates for the savings and borrowing accounts, because those change on a month-to-month basis.
Only place where if you pull out, you actually wind up, feeling... I was going to make a joke, but I can't because we're going to get banned probably. Anyway, in the green room, we have noted anti-chair thinker influencer and, of course, Bitcoin OG Pierre Rochard. Sir, thank you for coming on the program. How are you doing? How are you feeling? What's going on?
Very well. Thanks for having me on. And although I am anti-chair, I'm also a hypocritical influencer. So I'm sitting in a chair, of course.
You wouldn't be doing this standing up. Come on.
Pierre, tell us a bit about, first of all, what is your Bitcoin story? You're at Riot now. You've done a number of things. You have a podcast. Who is Pierre Rochard to the people who don't know you? Although I'm sure there's not that many left at this point.
So I'm, I think first and foremost, a student of the Austrian School of Economics. So that's kind of the analytical lens that I look at the world with. After that, I'm an accountant. So I started my career in financial auditing. And after that, I'm a software engineer. I learned how to code and did lots of Python and SQL and TypeScript. After that, you know, I was a product manager at Kraken for 3 years, so focused on Bitcoin and Lightning there. And now, as of about a month ago, I'm the VP of research at Riot, one of the largest publicly traded Bitcoin miners in the world.
I have tons of questions to do with Riot, but we're going to go into that later on. But let's talk about what's going on in the world right now, because you mentioned that you've dealt in the world of finance before. It's the world of finance is burning around us. We see the interest rates going up, debt to GDP is going up. Everything is going down in terms of wealth and valuation of everything. But what do you think is going on? You see like so many things that are going wrong, but Bitcoin remains the one constant here that we could put our money into and potentially save ourselves. Do you think that these people, these Keynesian fiat apologists, do you believe that they have any hope in hell of fixing what they have, or this thing is just ready to crash and burn right in front of our eyes?
Yeah, so I think that the economy is just so complex that nobody really understands what's going to happen, whether they are a central planner or a commentator on the outside. And that's why I find Bitcoin so interesting, is that Bitcoin is the opposite of that. I know exactly what's going to happen every 210,000 blocks. There's going to be a halving of the subsidy. I understand, you know, how the system functions. And I understand that, you know, private keys, how those work, and the security around that and multi-sig. So these are things where, you know, I don't have perfect certainty about them, but I have less uncertainty than about certainly the financial system, but even day-to-day things like my car. You know, like I have more confidence in my Bitcoin node software than in my car. So it's really, you know, we got to think about what's within our control and what's, you know, within our ability to understand. And Bitcoin allows us to hedge against the risk involved with all these centralized systems. So I really see Bitcoin as a decentralized risk management system that allows us to not have to worry about all the craziness going on in the fiat world.
Why don't we talk a bit about decentralization in Bitcoin and some of the stuff we've heard in the last little while, especially as proof of stake has become the sort of flavor of the month from our colleagues on the other side of the aisle. One of the things I hear all the time, Pierre, and I'm sure you've heard this over the years, is that the decentralization, I should say, of Bitcoin is really sort of more theater than pragmatic and based in reality, because the developers, for example, are a small group of people who, you know, presumably work together or sometimes you know, in lockstep with each other to try and push projects forward. We've seen this happen a couple of different times. SegWit obviously comes to mind, among other things. And I'm curious, what would you say about people who believe that the decentralization of Bitcoin isn't really what Bitcoiners say it is? How do you combat that that talking point from Ethereum and other coins as well?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think that they're trying to engage in moral relativism so that they don't have to engage on the kind of the universal claims. So what I mean by that is that you know, to say that that it's not decentralized if some people are writing code for it or some people are running nodes, I mean, it would be to argue that the only thing that is decentralized is if it does not exist, because then its inexistence would just make it, you know, fully decentralized, whereas anything that exists by definition is centralized because it exists somewhere. And I just, you know, I find that to be like just such a strong claim of like, well, you're just destroying the word decentralization, and now we just need to come up with a different word to describe what we're talking about. Perhaps a better terminology would be not having a single point of failure, or having respecting user rights is excellent terminology, and I'd give credit to Pete Rizzo for that, because I think that it it captures the central difference between Bitcoin and a system like Ethereum, right? Ethereum has regular difficulty bombs that allow it to, as the name implies, nuke all the nodes on the network and start a new network. And it's a highly coercive system, of course, because there's no way to defuse the bomb without creating a hard fork and thus, you know, Ethereum Classic or another altcoin. Bitcoin does not have this. The Bitcoin developers have not created anything like it. You know, they could even do something like automated updates, right? We see plenty of software out there where they will push an update onto you, whether you want it or not. And they'll even, or you know, a lesser version of that is to push an update and offer it to you. And then you can click upgrade now, or you can click later, right? Bitcoin developers have never and will never put that in the software, because ultimately, from their point of view, you should be seeking out an upgrade and opting into it if it benefits you. But if your software is working great, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. And that is the most user-friendly approach to software development, right? And so the most user-unfriendly way is to have proprietary software where you force the upgrade on them. And so Ethereum's kind of in between, right? It's open source still, but they force the upgrade on you. Bitcoin's open source, and not only do they not force the upgrade, they don't even prompt you to upgrade. You got to go seek it out to find a new version of the node software. So that, in my mind, is kind of the central difference between it. All of the other things, like, you know, they'll talk about, oh, Ethereum has multiple node implementations, Bitcoin only has one. Well, first, that's false. There are multiple implementations of the Bitcoin protocol. Second of all, they're all open source, so you can run them all. Third of all, they're talking about market share, which if Bitcoin Core, the C++ implementation that is kind of a descendant of Satoshi's code base, if that's the most popular software, who are we to second guess the users? I mean, who are we to tell the users, no, we need to force you to use other software? It just speaks to the quality of the software that is coming out of Bitcoin Core and how, you know, its competitors are unable to gain market share. There's nothing centralizing about that. It would be centralizing to try to dictate market share of software. So I think that there's a philosophical difference about means versus ends. So Ethereum people might want to use coercion and centralization in the means in order to achieve the ends of decentralization, whereas Bitcoiners have the opposite view of, hey, let's have the process be decentralized and the result will be whatever the result is, right? And so I think the key part is that it's anti-fragile. So if the Bitcoin Core developers go haywire and start, you know, introducing crazy things into the code base, that's getting decentralized very quickly. All right. That's not going to just the toxic Bitcoin plebs are not sheep who take orders from the developers. Right. Quite the opposite. They throw hissy fits over, such nonsensical things that they're accused of having, you know, an autoimmune deficiency or a kind of being overly sensitive to attacks. And I'm with the plebs on this one. I think that you have to be overly sensitive because ultimately we're talking about FU money, right? That's mm-hmm. the topic of the day.
Can I ask you a follow-up there, Pierre, before Len takes over? You are, sort of adjacent to the everything is a scam presentation done by a colleague of yours who we'll talk about a bit later in the show. Do you think that this is a sort of, you know, a similar belief held by plebs, you know, as far as the Bitcoin code and core and all that stuff? Do you think that this is sort of in the same vein that we just should assume that everything is potentially detrimental until proven otherwise?
Yeah, that's certainly the approach that Bitcoin Core developers have. So there is a review process for all pull requests. They don't just merge things in and then see if it works, you know. They look at the pull request, they study it, they read the code line by line, character by character, they test it themselves, they run it. They don't just merge things in willy nilly. And perhaps that's seen as gatekeeping and as, you know, being toxic and not, you know, being inclusive of all new code that is proposed. But at the end of the day, not only do they have to think about the code they want to run, right? Because most, I think all the Bitcoin Core developers probably run a Bitcoin node. So they're, you know, they're dog fooding. But also this is code that if they have a long-term commitment to the project and they're really intellectually invested in it and they want to contribute to it for the long-term, this is code that they're going to have to maintain for a long while. And so if they get a contribution from someone who has never made any contribution before and is just going to add 5,000 lines of complicated whatever, you know, even if it makes Bitcoin better, they might look at that and be like, hey, look, the maintenance hassle on here, if you're not going to stick around, if you don't have any like proof of work, probably not going to merge this in. So there's a lot of factors where, you know, we have to treat each other with mutual respect. You know, the Bitcoin Core contributors, they're just working on open source software. You know, we can't just like dictate that, hey, we want this soft fork or we want this hard fork in there and you have to do what we tell you to do. At the end of the day, because it's open source, you can create your own version of Bitcoin. And there are thousands of them, right? We call them altcoins.
Now, in terms of Bitcoin being attacked, and you've been in this game for a long time, I'd like to hear your views on potential attack vectors towards Bitcoin and what may potentially be attacking it. Would it be states that potentially put in regulations or maybe outright bans against Bitcoin? Maybe it could be internally bad actors or something else. I'd like to hear your thoughts about what we should be looking at going forward with Bitcoin as a perceived to be attacked. Like we even had not too long ago a civil war with the block size war. So I'm curious what your thoughts are about this.
Civil war?
There was a civil war.
Yeah, the block size war, the civil war. I mean, it's interesting because of Bitcoin's like node network architecture and decentralized governance. When I look back on 2017, I mean, it was basically like 10 people in a padded room screaming while everybody was just completely ignoring them and going on about their day, right? Like if we were to look at just what that situation was. And so I think that regardless of whether we characterize them as an attack or not, we should kind of just actually really be indifferent as to what the motives are of whether they're malicious or good motives. We should just look at ideas. And if it's a bad idea, we should argue against it. And we should, you know, implement code to defend ourselves against it if necessary, or just not run that code if it's, you know, just a bad idea like that. So, I think that's always going to be the number one problem for Bitcoin is bad ideas. There's that famous meme of the superhero who's like, I just heard about Bitcoin and I'm here to fix it, right? So everybody comes to Bitcoin with fiat brain. That's the default, right? We were all raised with fiat brain until the next generation is raised with Bitcoin brain. And so by default, everybody's going to come to Bitcoin with bad ideas. And our responsibility is to, one, refute those bad ideas, explain to people why those are bad ideas. And two, you know, hope that those people gain some humility from that and learn from it and come up with good ideas, or that they go fork off and start their own project. I think that's totally fine as well. It's really important for bad ideas to go to other projects rather than going into Bitcoin.
Yeah, that's 100% true about the bad ideas being dispersed. Now, a question for you, Pierre. Given your proximity now to, I don't want to say regulators, because I don't think you're particularly close to regulators per se, but certainly working with Riot, a publicly traded company, you're a little bit closer to the regulatory environment than a lot of Bitcoiners, a lot of Twitter plebs, a lot of people who do development for Core, et cetera, et cetera. What is, in your view, the role of the maximalist in this new and developing regulatory environment? And I'm curious to hear your thoughts specifically about legislation that tries to capture Bitcoin and other tokens in a favorable way. is it okay for the maximalist, you think, to look at some of these legislative ideas and say, okay, well, it's not great because it's sort of lumping Bitcoin in with other tokens. We've seen this in Canada recently is with buy limits being implemented or discussed. You know, is it okay for this to lump Bitcoin in if it's good for us, even if it's good for something else, even if there's a sort of misdefinition of the Bitcoin network or Bitcoin asset? Or is it the maximalist role in your view to say, no, we have to put our foot down here? I know this is, you know, going to be a little bit more of a fight because we're not accepting this this deal with the devil, you know, for example, something of this nature. What is the role of the maximalist these days, given that there's more eyes on the asset and the network than ever before?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think Bitcoin wins in the free market. I think it wins if there's a level playing field. Now, you know, from a policy perspective, I think that any kind of legislation that gets proposed, we should first and foremost look at it and pretend as if it was exclusively about Bitcoin. So if it says crypto, replace that with Bitcoin. You know, it, just look at it of, okay, let's pretend this is just about Bitcoin. Is this good legislation for Bitcoin? Right. And I think that that gives us like 90% of the answer, because if it's good for Bitcoin and it's good for other cryptocurrencies, I think that's fine, because I think the Bitcoin will win through the market process, not by getting legislation that is specifically favorable to Bitcoin and bad to other cryptocurrencies. Now, second of all, you know, there's competing interests, right? So, and there's competing political philosophies. Like my political philosophy, which is not necessarily that of, you know, my employer, my political philosophy is libertarianism. So I'm for less government. And so when I look at, for example, the SEC and what Gary Gensler is doing, the maximalist side of me says, hey, this is great. Gary is cracking down on these tokens that are, you know, centralized and bad. And the libertarian side of me says, well, this is an incredibly nuanced situation, because on one hand, I think that the people who have been harmed do have a tort and they do have cause for civil litigation and to be made whole through that process. And that's what would happen in a libertarian anarcho-capitalist society, right? Now, because the government sometimes and kind of the historical processes we have might not be adapted to the times, it just might be too expensive for people to engage in class action litigation and to be made whole, or they, you know, the laws or the historical precedent is just not there. So they're like, I don't know. I, at the end of the day, I just think that it's not our fight, it's theirs. So it's between the people who got scammed, the government, and the token issuers. Bitcoin had nothing to do with it, right? Like, it's kind of like the Silk Road. Like, that's between, you know, people who want to legalize drugs, the DEA, and legislators. Bitcoin is like this thing that's on the side here that's not really like central to the policy debate.
Well, another debate that's going on is how much energy that is Bitcoin is using, and a lot of people are saying that's a negative, a strike against it, and in fact there's so many people saying it emits too much carbon in the air and all that FUD that's been going around. How do we fix this? How do we get around this thing, because it seems to be this narrative is growing, and since we don't have a centralized body, we can't pay a PR firm to try to get away from this stuff. So what do you think is the best narrative for us as Bitcoiners to fight this ESG garbage that's being imposed on us?
Yeah, I mean, I think that for one, Bitcoin consumes tremendously little electricity, right? It's like less than 1% of the electricity. So it very much is a fabricated problem that is coordinated both, and it's an unholy alliance of the proof of stake crypto people joining hands with the fiat bankers. And they, you know, are allies in promoting centralized currencies versus a decentralized currency like Bitcoin. So proof of work is the only way to have a decentralized currency that is known to computer science. So I think that our role, or at least the way I see my role, is to educate around that. So, you know, I think that there's a lot of myths out there about alternatives to proof of work, or even about the value of decentralization, right? There's people who are like, oh, there's no value in having open source money. Like, it should all be proprietary corporate systems and, you know, run by the government. So, you know, I'm happy to like engage on those questions. And I think that that's the approach that we should have, is just explaining what the software engineering is, how Bitcoin actually works. And the other thing is that if we look at what their policy goals are, right, their policy goal is to have net zero carbon emissions by 2050. And if you look at Bitcoin's halvings, Bitcoin is going to have many halvings on its way to 2050. So by the year 2050, I don't think that Bitcoin, well, okay, let me rewind here. Bitcoin mining, hashing, that does not emit any CO2, right? It emits thermal heat like your computer, and it emits hashes. The CO2 emissions are coming from natural gas and coal-fired power plants. The only country in the world that is building coal-fired power plants at scale today is the Chinese Communist Party, right? So I think that, first of all, in terms of net zero, all of the energy of activists should be directed at the Chinese Communist Party, assuming that they are not funded by the Chinese Communist Party, right? Just putting that assumption in there, assuming that they are good faith concerned about carbon emissions. Right now, the problem in terms of growth of carbon emissions and absolute numbers is not the United States. It's not the West. It is developing nations. And the solution is nuclear. So good faith activists who are concerned about carbon emissions, assuming that they are honest and follow the science, should also be the number one proponents of nuclear power. And so with that in mind, by the year 2050, Bitcoin will consume far less electricity than people think because of the halvings, and that electricity will come from carbon-free nuclear. So I don't really see what the problem is here at all. I think the problem is primarily in the bad faith arguments that are being made.
I happen to agree with you, Pierre. Now, I'll push you a little bit, since you may be in the right chair. There's never really a right chair for you to be in, to be honest, given your history. But for tonight, you're in the right chair to answer this question. Given you work for Riot, and you guys obviously deploy miners at scale, how do you approach municipalities, states, governments who give you these arguments? Do you say something similar to what you just said there? Like, it's not going to be a problem in 30 years, 20 years? Or do you guys have, you know, if you can share something maybe a little more, you know, geared toward the parlance of the day, let's say, that you would say to these bodies to allow you to deploy your capital, you know, where you guys feel is the best fit?
Yeah, so I think the great thing about local governments and state governments here in Texas is that they actually know the numbers, right? They know how big the electricity grid is. They know how much power is being produced and how much power is being consumed. And so they know that Riot is a tiny percentage of that. And so they, you know, it's just not something that they are like concerned about, to my knowledge. I mean, if they are, I'm happy to talk about it. But what they're excited about is the job creation. Right. Riot has created directly hundreds of jobs and indirectly approximately 1,200 jobs in Rockdale. Rockdale was abandoned by Alcoa decades ago, where they shut down their aluminum factory there. And so we are, you know, providing lots of great jobs there, and also contributing back to the community and driving up the revenue for the government of sales taxes. Right. So local governments they understand the numbers, right? So they don't fall for kind of the catastrophism that you might see Twitter people try to promote. They're well informed, and they are excited about having responsible employers in their jurisdiction.
I'm not sure if a lot of people are aware, but Riot, I think they're going to be scaling up to get 1.7 gigawatts worth of available power in a distant, not too distant future. That's an enormous amount of energy that's going to be available to the Riot team. And I want to just talk a little bit about power curtailment that's going on in Texas, or that potentially comes around this time of year. How does this impact Riot, and how much of that power does get redirected back to the grid? It's not, probably not 100%. I'm assuming not 100%, but do you know what percentage-wise? Is it somewhere around 50%, 75% of all the power that you generate right now? And even with that 1.7 gigawatt factory coming out, I would imagine a lot of it during times of stress on the grid, some of that power, most of that power is going to be redirected back to the grid in your favor too, because you get tax credits as a result of that, or some sort of power credits as a result of that.
Yeah. So first let's talk about electricity. Electricity demand is highly variable. And so if you look at during the day when it's really hot outside and people are getting home from work, they're turning on their AC. And so electricity demand goes up during certain hours of the day, generally in the afternoon to late afternoon. At night, demand goes down because temperature goes down. And also there's hopefully not too many people watching TV, you know, 3 a.m. or gaming, right? So there's tremendous variability in the demand for electricity. On the supply side, you have two kinds of different suppliers. You have the reliables, that is coal, natural gas, nuclear, hydro as well, where you know that they're going to be producing a constant amount of electricity. And then within those categories, you have ones that are easy to turn on and ones that are not easy to turn on. So it's very easy to turn on a natural gas power plant that is off, or to turn off a natural gas power plant. Hydro or nuclear, you probably don't want to be turning those on or off all the time, right? So those are really the bottom of the stack, the baseload. Coal is in the middle. And so during periods of high demand, you see natural gas and coal power plants get turned on. And then when there's very low demand, they turn off. The unreliables are solar and wind. And so they are dependent, solar obviously, on sunlight, whether it's cloud coverage or day and night. And then wind, obviously dependent on the wind. So the Texas grid has a lot of solar and wind. And so depending on what's going on with those during the peak demand times, there can be an imbalance between the amount of demand and the amount of supply. And so you either fill that imbalance by turning on coal and natural gas power plants and emitting lots of CO2, right? Or you find a way to reduce demand. And the way Texas reduces demand is through a market process of, hey, we're going to increase, or the price of electricity is going to increase until people consume less electricity, right? So it's just like Uber with surge pricing. We're going to raise the price until either more supply comes online or we get less demand. And so Riot and Bitcoin hashers in general are uniquely placed to turn off during periods of high demand and reduce demand. So why are they uniquely placed? Well, one, if you compare it to industrial uses of electricity, it's very expensive for a factory to shut down for 1 hour or for 2 hours, right? They have an assembly line and they've got workers on the assembly line and they can't, it's just extremely expensive to just shut down the assembly line and be like, hey, we're going to curtail for 2 hours here. So, you know, have a snack or something. So, two, data centers right? They can't turn off, right? Imagine if, you know, Google was like, hey, you can't do this Google search right now because we're curtailing power. It's just like you know, hey, you don't have access to your corporate systems because our data center turned off for 2 hours to curtail power. So those are very expensive and just infeasible ways of curtailing power. Obviously, we don't want to ask residential or hospitals or schools to curtail power, right? Like, we want humans to consume electricity, right? This is like the best use of electricity is climate control and, you know, making sure that people are in a comfortable environment. And that should be number one priority is people. So Bitcoin mining, you can turn it on and off. You can turn it to 0% or to 50% or to, 33.33%. Like, you can do any percentage, and you can do it instantly. And there's no like, oh, we have this labor expense. And, you know, like you would have with a factory where, hey, oh, now the Bitcoin workers are not,
they're having a snack.
Yeah. So it is unique in, and on top of that, it is, as you mentioned, it's a lot of megawatts, a lot of gigawatts potentially at the grid level that could really provide a cushion during those peak hours and reduce demand. And also because they're reducing the demand when the price is high, they're helping lower the price, right? Because they're essentially selling electricity back to the grid at the highest prices, and thus pushing down the price that would otherwise be paid by residential users or, you know, any commercial users that are on the grid. So, and also it's a better alternative than turning on more natural gas and coal-fired power plants if your concern is carbon emissions, right? If you really are worried about carbon emissions, you should be really excited about Bitcoin mining on the grid, and you should be promoting it. And that's kind of the kind of the reality on the ground.
That was great, Len. We got to clip that answer. I had a buddy talking to me the other day, like I mentioned on the show on Monday, asking why Bitcoin miners are uniquely placed. And I honestly like didn't have a good resource for him. Now I got one. That was a good like 7 minute answer on why they're uniquely placed. So Pierre, you crushed that. Now since we're on the topic of mining and we're on the topic of power consumption, we may as well talk about proof of stake and the merge that's at this point, I think is like, I don't know, 7 hours, 6 hours away, something like that. I don't know exactly when it's happening, but at some point my timeline will be full of people with unicorn onesies, everyone, all of them weighing less than 130 pounds, soaking wet, jumping up and down and celebrating this triumph of computer science. So talk to me, Pierre, about the merge, the what are people missing about this change in the Ethereum network. The Ethereum bulls are super pumped about this. As you mentioned, they're sort of holding hands with the fiat bankers in this regard. What are these guys getting wrong? What do you think?
Well, the number one thing they're getting wrong is that there's already proof of stake tokens out there. So I don't really see what the breakthrough is here. Like, they're just joining all the other... I mean, if a proof of stake token went to proof of work, I would have the same reaction of like, yeah, okay. I mean, that already exists. I don't know what the excitement is about. Second of all, proof of stake does not solve the double spending problem, right? So that's kind of
pretty important. Yeah.
Yeah, it's important because that's what proof of work solves. So what the double spending problem is that you don't want somebody spending the same coin or the same token twice. And that the way Bitcoin solves that is by having this proof of work mechanism combined with the difficulty adjustment create a decentralized ordering or a sequence of sets of transactions that we call blocks. And this sequencing is based on proof of work, which is essentially a verifiable way of proving that you have done a set amount of work. In Bitcoin's case, an average of 10 minutes of computation, right, of SHA-256 squared. And they are committing themselves, the hashers, the workers, are committing themselves to a specific sequence of blocks. And that's why we call it the blockchain, right? That's what everyone's all excited about, right? Proof of stake doesn't do that. So with proof of stake, the stakers could provide, they could sign any number of different sequences of blocks. And somebody who comes along later on, they don't know which one's the right one. So this is called, you know, academics will call this long range attacks. And so it just completely defeats the purpose. So proof of stake doesn't solve the double spending problem. It's not a replacement for proof of work. The only reason that these systems don't collapse is because they have a centralized element to them, which is called checkpointing and which is called proof of authority. So when they say, hey, our blockchain is proof of stake, what they really mean is that it is proof of stake that is patched with proof of authority, which is a centralized system. And so they might as well just have a SQL database, right? The only reason that they are not doing that is because of regulatory arbitrage, where a regulator will put them in jail for a SQL database, but will applaud them for a proof of authority, database.
You said proof of authority, and that's always tied to CBDCs. And we're hearing a lot of that these days. If you look at the World Bank and the IMF talk about it, it seems to be on their agenda for the past month. And is there a coincidence that this is coming out at the same time that ETH is moving to a proof of stake? Is there any connection between the two, or am I just out to lunch here?
Get the tinfoil out. Let's hear it, Pierre. What is the connection between these two things, man?
Yeah, so I don't think that there is a connection. I'm sorry to blow up your conspiracy.
I'm going to go. Here. That's it. I'm done.
I do think that they're the same thing. So that's, you know, there's a conceptual connection, even if there's not a causal one. You know, really, I think that this is the challenge for regulators, is that they're currently trying to see, okay, is it a currency or is it a commodity? Or sorry, is it a security or is it a commodity? And really, it's a currency. And so when we look at it through the lens of a currency, Bitcoin is a decentralized public currency. Ethereum is a centralized private currency. The US dollar is a centralized private currency. And so Ethereum and the US dollar are in direct competition with each other. They're both centralized systems. And they both, you know, have these flexible monetary policies and all this. Bitcoin is entirely different from Ethereum and the US dollar because it's decentralized and it's a public system. And what I mean by public, I mean that Bitcoin did not have a unregistered securities offering, right? Like Ethereum did. So 60% of the Ethereum supply that we know of, because it's unaudited, the 72 million ETH was created in a centralized manner with the first block on Ethereum, right? Their Genesis block created 72 million ETH. Bitcoin's Genesis block created zero Bitcoin, zero spendable Bitcoin, mm-hmm. created 50 Bitcoin, but they're actually not in the UTXO set. So even if Satoshi wanted to, he would not be able to spend them. And all of the blocks subsequent to that were mined with proof of work. And so that's why Bitcoin is a public network, whereas Ethereum is a private network. Today, you know, it's that 72 million ETH is approximately 60% of the known unaudited supply of 120 million. And that 120 million is continuing to increase every day. We don't know where it will end up in the future. That's going to be up to the central bankers of Ethereum, who are going to decide what future supply is. In the past, Vitalik said that there would never be more than 100 million ETH. Now we're at 120 million. So, you know, take their forward guidance on monetary policy with a tremendous grain of salt, right? They're completely unaccountable. And, you know, they're less accountable than the Federal Reserve, which is astounding, right? And they're equally unaudited.
Joey, I got a quick follow-up to this. Now, with the proof of stake system, it basically incentivizes people to stake their ETH on there, and there's a, and you just mentioned there's a lot of ETH that was given out at the very onset. So it, to me, it seems like this is something that is even more centralized than what it is right now with the proof of work. It's just incentivizing holding on to it, staking it, and the people that have the most, well, they're going to benefit from the most. From what I understand, the top 100 the top 40% is of ETH, it belongs to only 100 different addresses. So it's a very small number of people own the top 40% of all ETH. So talk about the centralized nature of proof of stake. You can probably do it much better than we can. And we'd like to rip into how bad this is going to be moving forward.
There's that. And then also, Pierre, if you could, I mean, I'm a little unclear on how this you know, proposal for Ethereum to be base money is going to be met with, you know, like you said, this sort of manufactured scarcity. Everyone's heard this triple halving kind of bogus nonsense. But aren't they also claiming this offers a yield of sorts as well? Am I dreaming that? They're also saying this. How can all these things be possible at the same time?
And zero energy.
I just don't understand. Like, who is this fooling? It's not fooling me. I don't know. Talk to me about this. What are we missing here?
Yeah, great question. So I'll start with the first, which is really about the decentralization. Ethereum people will say, hey, look, this is concern trolling. Proof of stake is more decentralized than proof of work. I don't know how true that is, because they are in a very centralized manner transitioning to proof of stake. So the proof is in the pudding, right? Like they are starting it as centralized. There was one official Ethereum 2 contract deployed on the proof of work mainnet on Ethereum 1. And if you did not deposit your ETH into that official contract, that one official contract, you're not staking ETH 2. So it's entirely centralized. So I don't know what they're talking about with decentralization. Second of all, what are their incentives, right? So their incentives post-launch, you know, once they get this all, once the dust settles on the merge, is to raise the staking yield, right? Because that's just income to the people who are in charge of the system. Right, they're the ones who moved it to proof of stake. They're the ones who are earning the income. And so, you know, if why earn 4% when you could earn 6%? Why earn 6% when you could earn 8%? So, their incentive, and they have the ability to raise that rate, obviously, right? Since they had the ability to put it in place in the first place. The stated reason for having a staking yield is for the security of the network, right? They say we're going to have minimum viable issuance. We're going to issue as little as possible to secure the network, which is a lot like when the government says we're going to tax you as little as possible in order to secure the border, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, let's look at the border. Let's look at our taxes. Okay. So really, you know, I think that first of all, the subsidy that is the creation of new units, adding new units to the ledger, that does not pay for security, whether it's in Bitcoin or in Ethereum. What that pays for is to prevent seniorage, which is monopoly profits on the issuance of the asset. And so in Ethereum, it doesn't work because you actually do have monopoly profits on the issuance of the asset because it's not open entry, right? You can't, in order to stake ETH, you have to buy ETH. In order to mine Bitcoin, you don't have to mine any Bitcoin. That's the central, you know, difference from that perspective of the unforgeable costliness, right? That Bitcoin mining is hyper-competitive. That's why Riot is so focused on execution. Like, we operate on block time, right? Every 10 minutes counts. This is a hyper-competitive dog-eat-dog industry. Now, of course, we're well aware of that, and that's the challenge that we're embracing, and that's why we execute with urgency. Staking is not like that. Once you've got your percentage of the stake, you could reinvest your yield and just grow your percentage, right? And you just sit back and enjoy your Mai Tai on the beach, right? There's no work involved. That's the whole point, right? That's what they wanted to get away from, was work. They wanted to just enjoy the benefits of seniorage, of just printing money out of thin air. So what does contribute to security is the low cost of running a Bitcoin node. Ethereum is looking to go in the opposite direction of having very high cost nodes. And then the second way that you increase security is by having cold storage for your private keys. All of these DeFi things, all of these NFTs, you look at the security situation with them, it's catastrophic. Yeah. I mean, people are just losing their private keys left and right because the way that you engage with these systems is by signing arbitrary smart contracts using your private keys from your browser. It's like, just, it's on a different security level.
I think you're describing MetaMask.
Yeah. Well, I'm not going to name names here, but so it's, yeah. What they can do, the stakers, right? If they say, hey, look, if there are any double spends, then we have to increase the yield. Now, there's no connection between double spends and the yield, and there's no connection between double spends and the subsidy on Bitcoin as well. And with regards to transaction finality on Bitcoin, what pays for that is transaction fees, not the subsidy. Right? The subsidy is actually earned by the attacker, whether they censor transactions or not. So it's neither here nor there. So what the stakers could do in Ethereum is just do false flag attacks, just double spend themselves. Say, hey, look, the security's terrible. We have to raise the yield. And then you have all of these, influencers, crypto influencers who get paid to say whatever. And, you know, they'll go on YouTube and they'll say, oh, no, there's been an attack. We have to pay the stakers more. We're raising the yield. Also, it's good because, you know, it's the risk-free rate of return. And, we're going to attract more capital by printing more ETH. So this is all very good. And, it's what's going to happen. Like, maybe I should get on that gravy train, but I guess maybe I have too much integrity for that.
Joey, we got Rug Powell on our show to
give it. Pierre, honestly, I can't believe it. I'm laughing pretty hard over here. I got one Bitcoin related question for you. It'll be a quick one. Then we got one fun one to wrap up with. So you are in the mining game. You've been in the Bitcoin game for many years, as Len said earlier, and you're also in the content game. You and Michael Goldstein host the Noted podcast, which is it's a must subscribe if you're a Bitcoiner, for two reasons. One, because of the always interesting choice of music and other audio clips you guys use in the intros and outros, but also because the content's great. So Pierre, in your view, what are the Bitcoin podcasters, YouTubers, Twitter heads getting right about their messaging, and what are they getting wrong about their messaging?
That's too meta for me. that's too inside. No, they're all doing great. I love the Bitcoin community and the content creators. I don't have any, I'm not their manager.
Okay, fine. We'll let you skate on that. Now, to finish, we always ask the same question of our guest about their physical prowess. Okay, so if you and your co-host for the Noted podcast, Michael Goldstein, are standing next to each other in a parking lot, okay, it's paved, nice, clean asphalt. 40 yards away, Pierre, there's a checkered flag, okay, the finish line. You guys are both wearing your favorite pair of running shoes, shorts, muscle shirts, whatever you guys want to wear. Who's winning a 40-yard dash between you and Bitstein?
Oh, that's a good question. We've got to do it. I would hand it to Bitstein. I get shin splints from running on hard pavement. So, call me an old man. But what I will say is that before this podcast, I was at a place called Urban Air, where you jump on trampolines with your kids and you play dodgeball. And I did pretty well. So my physical prowess, with regards to my son, at least, who's 4 years old, is pretty decent. Yeah. And he's keeping me in shape.
So it's safe to say you lose the race, but you'll beat him in a dodgeball competition.
Trampoline dodgeball.
I think that I have the upper hand.
I like it. Sure. Pierre Richard, tell people where they can find you, what you're up to. Floor's all yours, man.
Yeah, find me on LinkedIn, Pierre Richard. I've been using it more often lately. I find it interesting. There's good things to reply guy on. Twitter handle at Bitcoin Pierre, and feel free to shoot me a DM. My DMs are open. If you're in the Bitcoin mining industry and you just want to chat about Bitcoin mining, you know, my door is open, as they say, happy to talk with anyone. I've learned so much from so many of the OG Bitcoin miners.
That's good to know. Pierre Richard, Riot Blockchain, among other things, too many to name. Thank you, sir, for your time. We appreciate it. Everyone else, take care of yourselves.
Great. Thanks for having me on.
Way to go, Pierre. Thanks, buddy. We appreciate it.